fact is, let us face facts. Muslim Filipinos are the enemies of Christian Filipinos. And this is a tragic condition. And I hope that in the course of the presentations that I will be making in the next few days, we will come to a better understanding of how this condition came to be and of the part that Christians have played in making Muslim Filipinos their enemies. And likewise, the part that Muslims have played, it takes two to tango, so to speak. But we are in the midst of a tragic warfare in Mindanao and Sulu that has cost upwards of 50,000 lives, displaced hundreds of thousands of people, shattered the dreams of millions, and the loss in property is beyond calculation. The pain and the suffering and the wounds are truly terrible. And somehow, some way, we have got to turn this condition of enmity around into a condition of friendship. And I think that I think most of us present have the desire that Muslims should that we should share the light that has come to us in Jesus Christ with them, and that it should find response among them. I think our first task is to change the condition of enemy to friend. Now, Herman Hagedorn, who was the biographer of Leonard Wood, once described the land of the Moros in very picturesque language. And I would ask you to look up at the outline map of Mindanao as I recite Herman Hagedorn's description of Morolandia. A vast green crab in tropic waters, stretching out an irritated claw, chasing after minnows that are skipping off towards Borneo. The vast green crab is the island of Mindanao. The irritated claw is the Zamboanga Peninsula. And the minnows skipping off towards Borneo is, of course, the Sulu Archipelago. And this is the land of the Moros. And I, by the way, will use that term, Moro. It is a perfectly fine term bestowed on the Muslim Filipinos by the Spaniards. The Spaniards called everyone who was a Muslim a Moro. And the Spaniards made a distinction between the Moros and the Indios. And there was nothing intrinsically pejorative in the use of the word Moro. The pejorative connotation came much later. And there's been an interesting swing of the pendulum in the use of that word Moro. For centuries, Muslim Filipinos were called Moros. And then in the early 50s, when there was a resurgence of Islam, and Muslim Filipinos became very sensitive at the connotation that had attached to the word Moro, pirate, slaver, lecher, thief. Never turn your back on a Moro. You can never trust a Moro. Behave yourself or I'll give you to a Moro, says the mother to her child. Huh? With all of the bad connotation that is attached to the word Moro, that is the psycho-sociological burden of 400 years of hostility, well, Muslims became very sensitive about that word Moro and said, please call us Muslims. We are Muslims. We are not smugglers. We are not bandits and pirates. We are not immoral. We are Muslims. And so for 20 years or more, there was great sensitivity about this word moral, and Christians were very cautious about speaking about Muslims, and when Muslims were present, they would call them Muslims. When Muslims were not present, they would call them Moros. And the connotation that attached to the word Moro simply transferred to the word Muslim. And instead of Moro smugglers, you had Muslim smugglers. Instead of Moro pirates, you had Muslim pirates. Huh? And so the change in name, the change in name did not result in a change of attitude at all. It is the history that needs to be changed, not the name. And the fact is that Muslim Filipinos have been the victims of bad press and bad history. It's been written mostly by their enemies. And so we have perpetuated a very negative image concerning Muslim Filipinos that needs to be revised. That does not mean that there have not been bad Muslims. I imagine that the proportion of bad Muslims to the Muslim population is about the same as the proportion of bad Christians to the Christian population. Huh? Now, in the course of my presentations, I will be talking first of all about the arrival and expansion of Islam in the Philippines. That's the focus for today. Tomorrow, I would like to talk about the character of Muslim-Christian encounter in the Philippines from 1578 to 1978 is the 400th anniversary of the Spanish attack on Muslim sultanates in Mindanao and Sulu. The first Spanish military expedition against the sultanates in Mindanao and Sulu took place in 1578. 400 years. I would like then on Wednesday morning to talk about how Muslim Filipinos in our own time are caught between the forces of integration on the one hand and secession on the other, and some of the dynamics behind that situation. And then on one Wednesday afternoon, I hope to summarize for you and with you, and I say with you because there are many of you who work, of course, among Muslim Filipinos and know a great many of the details of the reality of life among Muslims. And I hope that in the course of our presentations you will feel free to raise questions, to make comments. Brief, please. I only have an hour each time. Make comments about the situation as you see it in your own places. But I want to talk about the winds of change on Wednesday afternoon that are occurring in Muslim Filipino society at the present time. Now, before we look at the arrival and expansion of Islam in the Philippines, let us focus a little bit on the Muslim population as it is today. There are about 2.2 million Muslims in the Philippines. 2.2 million Muslims. Now, that is actually a mystical figure. It is not arrived at by scientific investigation. Even the Philippine Bureau of Census and Statistics uses, I think, rather pre-scientific methods at arriving at population figures. But based on projections of figures from the Bureau of Census in 1975, we can estimate that there are about 2.2 million Muslims in the Philippines. Now, the Muslims themselves, for a variety of reasons, claim many more than that. I've seen figures as high as 5 million. The usual figure is there are 3 or 4 million of us Muslims. The tendency on the part of Muslims, for rather interesting sociological and political and economic reasons, has been to pad the figure. On the other hand, there has been an equal tendency on the part of others to underestimate the Muslim population. A Jesuit priest recently wrote an article in which he estimated that the population of the Muslims in the Philippines cannot be more than 1,450,000 and is probably less than that. And I've looked over that essay very carefully, and in fact, I have used it as an appendix in a forthcoming book. It's a very well thought out study, but even it uses rather pre-scientific means at arriving at this guesstimate. It's a guesstimate, not an estimate. And so when I use statistics, please keep in mind that I am tending to to be impressionistic. And the impression I am using is the impression of the Philippine Bureau of the Census Bureau. All right, 2.2 million Muslims are divided into 13 ethno-linguistic groups. 13. But 93% or 94% of all Muslim Filipinos are found in only 4 of the 13 groups, meaning that the others are really quite small, numbering only a few thousand. The 4 largest groups, beginning with the largest, are the Maguindanaoan, who are found in the Cotabato area, the Cotabato region. What used to be Cotabato province is now divided into 4 provinces. And only one of those provinces has a Muslim population majority, and that is the province of Maguindanao. And the province of Sultan Kudarat has somewhere between 36 and 40% Muslim population. That's the next largest Muslim populated province, and it's a minority. The Maguindanaoan are the largest of the Muslim groups. The second largest are the Maranao Ilanun, and I put those two together. The distinction between Maranao and Ilanun has not been very carefully and precisely drawn, and for much of census counting over the decades, they have simply been lumped together. They do make a distinction between themselves, among themselves. But the fact is the Maranao and the Ilanun or Iranun are ethnically and linguistically very closely related. Very close. They are close cousins. And they are found predominantly in the province of Lanao del Sur and along the coast of Iliana Bay, stretching over into North Cotabato and Maguindanao. But the Maranao Ilanun are the next largest group. And incidentally, the Maranao Ilanun and Maguindanaoan are very, very closely related linguistically and ethnically. And undoubtedly, these three groups spring from a common progenitor not many centuries back. The Maguindanaoan have traditionally occupied the broad valley of the Polangi River. The Maranao are associated with the great and beautiful Lake Lanao. They are people of the lake, Maranao, people of the lake. And the Ilanun or Iranun have, as I say, are very closely related to the other two, so that in many respects they constitute one Mindanao people, and their languages are so closely related that you can speak of them as one Mindanao language in a sense. Maguindanaoan is about 75% intelligible to the Maranao. The Maranao are an R, and the Maguindanao an L people. Or is it the other way around? I keep forgetting. Maranao, Malanao. Oh, I think it's the Maranao that are actually the L, but I'm not certain. Ah, the Maranao is the R, all right, and the Maguindanao is the L. All right, then the next largest group are the Taosug, and the homeland, the great homeland of the Taosug is Holo Island, and the islands nearby Holo, but the Taosug are scattered throughout the Sulu Archipelago, and there are some in southern Mindanao, and there are some in Borneo. But the Taosug is the next largest group, and then the so-called Samal. And by the way, let us learn, beginning today, if we do not know it already, let's begin now, today, to call the Samal Sama. Sama, not Samal. Samal is a Taosug word which means untidy and dirty. Not very careful about your sanitation. And the Taosug have sometimes applied this word to the Sama. Most often they apply it to the Bajau, and so do the Sama. It's not a very, it does not carry a nice connotation. And John Johnson can probably elaborate more authoritatively on that. They call themselves the Sama, which connotes together and togetherness. And they don't like to be called Samal. And the Sama are then the fourth largest group. And these four groups, Maguindanao, Maranao, Ilanun, Taosug, and Sama, constitute about 93 or 94% of the total Muslim population in the southern Philippines. Now, Dean Cesar Mahul, a very distinguished Muslim historian, Muslim Filipino historian, who is dean of the Institute of Islamic Studies in the Philippine Center for Advanced Studies at the University of Philippine System, Dean Mahul has provided five stages. He has outlined or defined five stages in the Islamization of Mindanao and Sulu. Five stages. The first stage was marked by the coming of Arab and other foreign Muslim traders and their settling in the Sulu Archipelago. And a little later on in that same stage, there came Arab missioners, probably Sufi in background. And they were Maktumin. Maktumin. I'll get to that in just a moment. We have hard evidence on the existence of a Muslim community in Sulu, on the island of Holo, actually, early in the 14th century. For centuries, Sulu sultans were enthroned as sultans at a tempat on Buddhatu behind Holo town. A tempat that was characterized by a stone grave marker written in Arabic. And the grave marker was for one Tuan Makbulu at that coming from that period. Undoubtedly, there were other grave markers, probably made out of coral or out of wood, and simply weathered away, and we've lost, we just don't know of their existence. But here was a grave stone, carved in stone, in Arabic, and the date is 710 A.H. And this tempot where this stone was located was venerated down through the centuries to our own time. When I saw this stone in the late 60s, it had already been shattered by vandals, and it was broken into many pieces. But we have photographs of that stone when it was whole. And this stone, you know, did not just drop out of the heavens on the earth. It presupposes a maker, and it would have had to be made after the man's death. It was inscribed in Arabic. And on the basis of the existence of this grave marker, it is possible to predicate the existence of a maybe small Muslim community on the island of Holo as early as 1310. And very likely that community had existed maybe a decade or two decades prior to the setting up of that stone. So it is conceivable, says Dean Mahul, that a small Muslim community existed on Holo at the end of the 13th century. Now, as Dr. Hawk said about the Christians in Mecca, the Christians in Mecca were present, but they were not preaching. And while we can perhaps point to some hard evidence of the existence of Muslims in Holo, late in the 13th century, early in the 14th century, the best we can do is to say they were present, but they were not preaching. We do not have any evidence of Islamization, that is, the taking root of Islam and the adoption of Islam and the preaching and teaching of Islam. We have no evidence of Islamization until later in the 14th century. Now, the community that set up this tombstone of 1310 may very well have been made up of one or two or three or four, I don't know how many, traders. We do know that that Muslims were trading along the coast of China, and in the 9th century at Canton, there was an Arab trading community. And there was trade between Old Bwansa, the old name for Holo, around the 10th and 11th century. And it is quite possible that Arab or other Muslim traders found their way to Holo in late in the 13th, early in the 14th century, and simply intermarried with the local population, and perhaps raised up their children as Muslims, possibly. But by the time of the arrival of the first Arab missioner of whom we have any knowledge or data at all, Karim al-Maktoum, around 1380, the ground must have been prepared some way. The tarsilas, the genealogies of the Tausug speak of the coming of Karim al-Maktoum. Al-Maktoum, interestingly enough, al-Maktoum is from the Arabic, and it means father, it means master. It was a title applied to distinguished Sufi teachers, originally on the east coast of India. And what we know about al-Maktoum, the Karim al-Maktoum, is very largely speculation based on the thinnest kind of evidence. But the fact that he bore the title al-Maktoum suggests, well, we know he was an Arab. He bore the title al-Maktoum. It is not unthinkable that he came to Bwansa, to Holo, via the east coast of India, where he might have spent a time, took a trading vessel from the east coast of India, found his way to China, and came from China to Holo. One of the interesting things recited in the Tarsila is that Karim al-Maktoum came in an iron pot. In an iron pot. That's rather difficult. There are lots of iron pot stories of people in folk literature around the world. But Dean Mahul suggests that the Sulawanos might have been very much impressed with the amount of metal that went into the construction of Chinese junks, trade junks. And from that fact, they might have, there grew up the tradition that he came in an iron vessel or an iron pot. But it is not, Dean Mahul would put his money, if he were a gambling man, on the square that said, Karim al-Maktoum, an Arab, came to Holo via the east coast of India, where he may have spent a time and was recognized as an al-Maktoum, a Sufi teacher and missioner, found his way to China and from China to Sulu in 1380, around 1380. And the traditions are strong that he taught adults and children on the beaches of Holo, and that he went to other islands. And what is hailed as the oldest mosque in the Philippines is found at Tubigindangan in Simunul Island, where if you visit that mosque, you will be shown hardwood pillars that are said to be part of the original mosque built by Karim al-Maktoum. There are, incidentally, several places where the grave of Karim al-Maktoum are to be found. One can speculate the reason for that. One possibility is that there were several Maktoumin. There was more than one Maktoum. Another is that, like the Christians, we spread our relics around pretty widely. All right, so the first stage in Islamization was perhaps the preparing of the ground by a small Muslim trading community in Holo at the opening of the 14th century, and later in that century, the coming of the first Arab missioner. The second stage takes place very late in the 14th and in the 15th century, the coming of additional influences from Sumatra. The Tarsilas speak of the arrival of Raja Baginda Ali from Manangkabau in western, did I say the east coast of India, by the way? I meant the west coast of India, not the east coast. I sometimes get starboard and port mixed up, and east and west and so forth. I am from the east. You have to go east to America. But people say you're from the west, you see, and I can't ever make up my mind on that. All right, the coming of additional influences from Sumatra reflected in the arrival of Raja Baginda Ali from Manangkabau on the west coast of Sumatra at the end of the 14th or the first part of the 15th century, the early 1400s. The Tarsilas speak of his coming at the head of a great fleet of praus. They also speak of sticks with fire, meaning that Raja Baginda Ali apparently had firearms, which impressed the Sulawanos. And some way or other, he insinuated himself into the leadership of Bwansa society. And quite possibly, the use of firearms was involved. And by the way, I have to make a point here. In general, the coming and the spread of Islam in the Philippines was by a quiet and peaceful process, accompanied by an absolute minimum of coercion. Only in two instances can we point to the possibility that some coercion was involved, and it's not at all clear. The record of Christianity's coming to the Philippines is rather different, if I may say so. There was a great deal of coercion involved in the Christianization of the Philippines. A minimum of coercion involved in the Islamization of the Philippines. Well, they were intermarried. And by the way, this phenomenon of Southeast Asian princes sailing around looking for a place to settle and rule was not at all uncommon. We have evidence of the same kind of phenomenon right down to the end of the 19th century, where a prince of a royal house may have been beaten out of succeeding his relative as the ruler, and he had to get out. And so he and his followers would leave, and they would sail around looking for a place to settle and establish their own new rule or kingdom. This, as I say, was not at all unusual in Southeast Asian history, and it happened here in Sulu with the coming of Raja Baginda Ali at this time. Now, Raja Baginda Ali was a Muslim. He was a Muslim. And the fact that he was a Muslim and the fact that he became ruler in Buanza, in Sulu, guaranteed the preservation of the work of Muslim missioners and gave prestige, political prestige, if you will, to the new religion that was just gaining momentum in Sulu. All right, the third stage in the coming of and spread of Islam was the establishment of Islamic political institutions in the 16th century, in the middle of the 16th century and on. The establishment of Islamic political institutions, particularly the Sultanate. And this was the work of a distinguished Arab scholar and jurist, Sharif Abu Bakr al-Hashim. And Sharif Abu Bakr was an Arab, found his way to Sumatra and Malacca, and eventually found his way to Buanza, where he married Paramasuli, the princess, the daughter of the aged Raja Baginda Ali. He married into the family of the ruler. And when father-in-law died, Abu Bakr succeeded him in his political position as ruler, or as the chief leader, let me say that. A ruler connotes a kind of political position that is too strong. But he was one of the chief figures politically in Sulu. And Sharif Abu Bakr, it was Sharif Abu Bakr who furthered the mission, outreach of Islam on the island of Jolo and some of the other outlying islands. And he introduced the kind of, maktab, the informal training of the young in Islam. And he succeeded, as I say, to his father-in-law's position. And he was held in such high respect that he was able to establish the Sultanate with himself as Sultan. The fact that he styled himself, or was styled, Sharif, indicated that he was a descendant of the prophet's family, that the prophet's blood crossed through his veins. And the tradition is very strong in Islam that one who would be sultan must have the prophet's blood in his veins, must be a royal person. Sharif Abu Bakr established the Sulu Sultanate sometime after the middle of the 15th century. And the Sulu Sultanate was maintained in virtually unbroken succession from Sharif Abu Bakr down to the 20th century. And in fact, we have a Sultan of Sulu now, semi-officially recognized by the Philippine government, who is a direct descendant of the Sharif ul-Hashim. I'm going to say something a little later about the character of Abu Bakr's missionary work on behalf of Islam. But let me get on to other things. The fact that other leaders, other coastal tonalais or datus in Sulu recognized the paramountcy of the Sharif ul-Hashim as sultan, the fact that the Sharif ul-Hashim was able to create the sultanate is itself evidence of the deepening Islamic consciousness that had occurred in Sulu by his time. All right, the fourth stage was the expansion of commercial and political contacts with other parts of the Dar al-Islam, the household of Islam, in Southeast Asia, in the Malay world, late in the 15th and early in the 16th century. It was at this time, incidentally, that Sharif Kabunsuan began his work in the Cotabato River Valley, the Polangi River Valley. Salibi, an American of Syrian birth, Najib Salibi, writing in the early years of this century, speculated that Sharif Kabunsuan arrived at Cotabato around 1475. Dean Mahul, on, I think, better evidence, feels that Sharif Kabunsuan was part of the fallout of the collapse of the Malacca Sultanate, and that it was after 1510 that Sharif Kabunsuan came to the Philippines. But anyway, Sharif Kabunsuan was another of these princes looking for a place to get established. And he came, it is said, with a fleet of Sama'a. We're not using Sama'a anymore, are we? No more. He came with a fleet of Sama'a, whom he had associated himself with in Johor, and came to the mouth of the Polangi, and eventually insinuated himself into the leadership of the Maguindanaoan people near what is today Cotabato City. He became recognized as a distinguished foreign personage. He impressed the local leaders. He intermarried into the local society, and he was a vigorous, aggressive evangelist, if you want to use that Christian term, evangelist for Islam. And indeed, there's evidence that he was a little bit too aggressive, and that he offended some and threatened many. And there is also some evidence that under Kabunsuan there may have been a little undue pressure applied. But in any case, the traditions are very strong in the Tarsilas or Salsilas, the genealogies of the Maguindanao and Maranao. The traditions are very strong that Sharif Kabunsuan became a leader in the Cotabato area, that he preached Islam up the Polangi River Valley and along the coast of the Yana Bay, and even as far as Malabar. And the Maranaos have tradition that that Kabungsuan came to Lanao. That is unlikely. Islam probably penetrated into the lake area from the Iliana Bay coast, or even from the coast of northern Mindanao. The pattern was to spread from the coast inland up the river valleys. But Sharif Kabungsuan established himself then as a power in the Cotabato region early in the 16th century. He, by the way, did not style himself Sultan. And we do not have any sultans of Maguindanao until his great-great-grandson, Kudarat, in the 17th century. Kudarat was the first, he was a direct descendant of Sharif Kabungsuan, and he is the first to style himself Sultan. Interestingly enough. All right, but I'm getting ahead of the story. This fourth stage, then, was the expansion of commercial and political contacts with other parts of Dar al-Islam in Southeast Asia, in the Malay world, late in the 15th, early in the 16th century. There is evidence of the coming of Javanese Muslim missionaries to the southern Philippines. There is abundant evidence of the assistance rendered by different Muslim princes in Borneo, in Makassar, in Sumatra, coming to the aid of Maguindanao and Sulu leaders as they were struggling against the invasions of the Spaniards. And rich trade and commercial relations and intermarriage between royal houses of these Muslim principalities in eastern Indonesia and what is today Malaysia. And so the growing Muslim community in the Philippines was firmly on the map of Islam in Southeast Asia by the 17th century. Itinerant preachers and teachers continued to arrive. And at this time, Alawi Balpaki, for whom credit is given for the Islamization of islands in what is today Tawi-Tawi province. Alawi Balpaki belongs to the late 16th or early 17th centuries. And he was a foreign Muslim coming in on the wave of these commercial and political contacts. All right, the fifth and last stage are the present influences coming from the intellectual centers of the Islamic world in the United Arab Republic, especially Al-Azhar University. And also from Libya. And the coming of Muslim teachers and missionaries from Egypt and Indonesia and Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and so forth. And this is a post-World War II phenomenon. This is the fifth stage. We are in this stage now. The fifth stage of the Islamization of the Philippines. And you may say, well, what happened all those other centuries? You left us hanging in the early part of the 17th century, and now you jumped up here to the 20th century. What happened were centuries of moral wars. And the Spanish moral wars, which we will discuss tomorrow, which really slowed down and more internalized the process of Islamization. But the fifth stage has been the resurgence of Islam, which has been a post-World War II phenomenon. And it has been brought about by the increasing number of hajis, Thousands, thousands of Muslim Filipinos have gone annually on the Hajj and have come back revivified, if you will, renewed in their Islam. Many Muslim teachers from abroad have come to the Muslim areas to teach in Muslim schools, madrasa, and to become imam of mosques. And they have helped to bring about a renewal, a resurgence of Islam. There have been hundreds of Muslim Filipinos who have gone abroad to study in Islamic centers in Egypt, as I say, and Libya, and elsewhere. And this resurgent Islam is pressing in many ways, and we'll describe this in more detail on Wednesday, have been pressing for a purification of Islam in the Philippines, a purging of some of the pre-Islamic characteristics of Philippine Islam. Islamization, and this is the point I would like to make, Islamization is still continuing at the present time. All right, let me very quickly, summarize what I see to be the impact of Islamization. First of all, Islamization, as I stressed before, was generally peaceful. It was a quiet penetration, and only in two instances, that of Raja Baginda Ali and perhaps Sharif Kabunsuan, has there been any hint of undue coercion. Islam teaches there is no compulsion in religion. There is no compulsion in religion. That's what Islam teaches. That has not always been what it has practiced. And ladies and gentlemen, there has been a wide gap often between what Islam preaches and what Islam does. And in that respect, it resembles Christianity, doesn't it? I mean, we are not going to be self-righteous and say that we Christians, of course, always live up to what we profess. No way. But nevertheless, I think that in the Philippines, Islam has done a better job of living up to its ideal of no compulsion in religion than has been the case with Christianity in the Philippines. We can tell a different story in other parts of the world, but not in this part of the world. Generally peaceful. Little evidence of the use of force. Haji Bhutu, the prime minister of the Sultan of Sulu early in the 20th century, told a tradition of his people concerning the missionary methodology of Sharif Abu Bakr. And this is a story widely told in Sulu concerning how Abu Bakr went about spreading Islam. And he was different in this regard from Kabunsuan, so far as we can see. And the story goes as follows. The hill people, that is the people in the interior of Holo Island, were still unconverted. And the coast people said to Sharif Abu Bakr, "Let's fight the hill people and convert them to Islam." But Abu Bakr would not allow it, and instead told the people to pound rice and make cakes and clothing. Then the coast people marched inland to a place now called Pahayan. And Abu Bakr sent word to the headman that he was an Arabian who could be spoken to by writing on paper. The headman, called in those days Tomawai, said that he did not want to see him, for he did not want to change the customs of his ancestors. So Abu Bakr approached, threw cakes and clothing into the houses of the hill people. The children ate the cakes, but the older people thought them poison and gave them to the dogs. The dogs were not killed, And the children went out to the camp of Abu Bakr, where they were treated kindly. The two tribes came to an understanding. That night, Abu Bakr slept in the house of the headman. The chief had a dream that he was living in a large house with beautiful decorations. And Abu Bakr interpreted the dream, saying that the house was the new religion and the decorations its benefits. The news spread, and after much difficulty, the people were converted. Hint. All right, a second impact of Islamization. Oh, and by the way, this history of peaceful penetration is something that Muslims value very highly. And they are continually reminding Christians that our Islam came peacefully. Your Christianity came with the sword and the cannon of the Spaniards. Well, another thing was the spread from the coasts. Islam spread from the coasts into the interior following the river valleys. It spread from the major groups to the client groups. And it was also brought in by immigrant groups. The Sangyas of Sangir Island brought their Islam from Indonesia. They also brought their Christianity, because some Sangyil are Christians, I'm told. And the Sama, some of the Sama, brought Islam with them when they migrated in their boats to the Philippines. The spread of Islam was accelerated in response to the European incursion in Southeast Asia in general and the Philippines in particular. Islamization was taking place only a century or so before the arrival, or 2 centuries before the arrival of the Spaniards. The Spaniards came permanently in 1565. And as we will point out tomorrow, the Spaniards came in a spirit of crusade. And the Muslims saw the challenge at once. And their Islam was a part of their identity over against the Spaniards. And they accelerated the Islamization process into the interior of the larger islands in Mindanao and Sulu, partly in response to the challenge of the Spanish Christian invasion. Now, as I had pointed out before, Islam is still expanding. You may be surprised to learn that there is a Converts to Islam Society headquartered in Caloocan City in Manila. That society does not issue statistics as to how many members belong. But I was given the figure from one member of 3,000. There are 3,000 Christian converts to Islam in the Convislam Society, based in Caloocan City. Can you name 3,000 Muslim converts to Christianity? Huh? And when a Muslim says to me and speaks very angrily, "You Christians are always out to convert us. Ah, you Christians are always out to convert us." I laugh and say, "Well, I don't know what you're worrying about. You fellows are far more successful in terms of numbers there than we are." Huh? Islam is still expanding. It is expanding among the discontented Christians who are, as Dr. Haq says, searching for God. And somehow there's been a failure of the Christian churches to help them in that quest. And Islam, for some, is filling the need. And there's expansion of Islam among some of the tribal Filipino groups. In Palawan, for example, a number of the Palawani have become and are becoming Muslims. And some of the Tiroi in Cotabato. And sometimes there is social and economic and other kinds of pressures involved with some of these groups living next to aggressive Muslim groups. But the fact is that Islam is continuing to expand numerically and also spiritually and in its understanding of the teachings and doctrines of Islam. You hear it said, and here I've got to close because my time is up. By the way, I think that is Ebenezer Standard Time. It's Ebenezer Standard Time. Philippine Standard Time, when you hear the gong, Philippine Standard Time puts it the time now at 10:05. Gong. That's Philippine Standard Time. That is Ebenezer College Standard Time. Fair enough. That's all right. And if we want to be under Ebenezer Time, we'll be under Ebenezer Time. Right. Right. This is conference standard time. All right. Let me say that, and here I must close. In 1,000, at least 1,000 different ways, a Muslim from the Middle East or a Muslim from Pakistan or India would immediately recognize Muslim Filipinos. It's easy for those who do not know Islam to say, oh, these Muslim Filipinos are not really Muslims. And those who get their knowledge of Islam by reading an article in the Encyclopedia Britannica about what Islam is will immediately say, oh, no, they don't have Islam among the Muslims in the Philippines. We talk about Philippine Islam as being something quite different from Islam anywhere else. To a certain extent, that is true. And the reason is that Islam has fallen like a silken veil on the cultural landscape of this place. The cultural landscape in the Philippines is different from the cultural landscape in Indonesia, different from the cultural landscape in India, different from the cultural landscape in Saudi Arabia. And when the silken veil of Islam falls on these different landscapes, you will see different profiles. But at the same time, in 1,000 ways, you will find that Muslim Filipinos are identifiably Muslim. There are mosques. There is the azan, the call. There is the salat done in the common and traditional way. There is Ali and Fatima and Abdullah. And hundreds and hundreds of Muslim names that are recognizable all over the Muslim world. There's the white turban of the Haji. There's the observance of Ramadan. And I could go on all morning reciting the things that Muslim Filipinos do that Muslims everywhere in the world do. Huh? And they are identifiably Muslim. Moreover, and this is, I think, the most important impact of Islam. And there is, above everything else, the disposition to be Muslim. Muslim Filipinos do not generally want to be anything else. They want to be Muslim. And in that connection, they are eager to have a law system recognized based on the Sharia, a law system recognized in the legal system of the Philippines. They want to become better Muslims, if anything. And there is a real struggle in this direction. And the impact of Islam is mighty, and it's going to get stronger and not weaker as the years go by. Thank you very much.